Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. It was more than a decade ago when writer Zadie Smith burst onto the literary scene with her first novel, White Teeth. Set in the ethnic neighborhood in northwest London, where she grew up, White Teeth captured the diverse, vibrant rhythms of a city in transition. Zadie Smith returns to the same place in her new novel, N.W. But where White Teeth was a wild ride into a whole new world, N.W. is a more complex exploration of where the inhabitants of that world have landed. Zadie Smith was born in northwest London and is the author of White Teeth, The Autograph Man, On Beauty, and the essay collection Changing My Mind. It is a great pleasure to welcome Zadie Smith to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
When this novel came to you, at what point did you know that you wanted to explore this part of London once again?
It kind of crept up on me. I didn't think I would ever write about that neighborhood again, but it really started with a real incident that there was a girl in my neighborhood who was knocking on doors, pretending that her mother had had a heart attack and then fleecing people for 20, 30 pounds each time, which she was using on cocaine. And I kept on hearing this story, and one of the things that people kept on saying about it was, you know, she was pretending to be desperate, so outrageous, she was pretending to be desperate. And I kept on thinking, well, she probably was desperate, because you have to be desperate to do something that crazy with the constant danger of being caught or someone calling the police. So that's what interested me, the kind of outrage of the people who had been tapped for money and the genuine desperation of the girl who was doing it.
It is an exploration about how we feel desperation and how we view desperation, isn't it?
Well, one of the things that struck me too is that when somebody's, you know, obviously in dire straits on the street, it's much easier to walk past them. But for several reasons, that scenario with the girl is difficult. One, because it's your neighborhood. Secondly, because she's in your house. And then I added this thing, which didn't seem unlikely to me, that maybe she went to your school. Because in a neighborhood like mine, with big schools, with many kids who go on to very different paths, you're quite often confronted with this extremity of the difference of ends. One person does one thing, another person supposedly fails by contemporary margins. So I was interested in that idea. What do you owe this person who was once your neighbor?
So in getting that tone and certainly giving us a sense of place, for you, what was necessary to do to get that right?
Well, I was away from home. I think the feeling of love and nostalgia for a place really increases when you're away from home. That was really helpful. And I started reading a lot about the history of London. That may not be obvious from the book because it's not a historical novel, but it's a bit like that iceberg you have to have underneath, even if you're only writing about the tip. It interested me some of the kind of historical echoes. Like, I just lived through the riots in London last year, and there was an English peasants' rebellion in 1381, which was very similar, apart from people ran into London and started cutting off people's heads instead of stealing trainers. So those kind of historical echoes in the city interested me, the link between now and then.
When you talk about that sense of nostalgia, does that color the writing at all? Because it doesn't necessarily feel nostalgic in the reading of it.
Well, it's funny because to the people I know, like the local people who've read it, they see and feel the nostalgia. The funny thing to me is that I guess readers from different kinds of backgrounds think that the places I'm describing are in some way grim, but to me they're really treasured places, you know, from Hampstead Heath to the council estates to the street corners. These places are not ugly to me, that they're beautiful. So I felt very nostalgic writing those scenes. But I think from a different perspective, if you grew up in a big house in a very middle class neighborhood, maybe it just by rights looks like some terrible grim scenario. But to live it isn't particularly grim. It's interesting. And I wanted to try and get the sense of what it's like to live on a corridor with a lot of different people and know that their lives are going to turn out a lot of different ways. It's not just depressing, it's also enlivening.
And living through it, did you always find it interesting and fascinating?
I guess I did. I mean, maybe everybody finds their own childhood fascinating, though. That's what you find out when you sit in a bar and people start telling you about their childhood. It's inherently fascinating for you, but the challenge when you're writing is trying to convey some of that interest to other people. I mean, there is something unique about my neighborhood in that because it's such a transitional place and so many waves of immigrants grow through it. In a way, it's a tiny microcosm of the 20th century at least, because you can see these waves of first, for instance, Jewish emigration, then Bengali, Jamaican, Irish, and then passing on to Ethiopian, Somalian, Iraqi, Afghani. So you can see these waves of war and civil war and trauma. Everything washes up in my neighborhood. So as a kid, that was pretty fascinating to suddenly wake up one morning and find out that 15% of your school was now Somali and to wonder why. All of that stuff did interest me, or Bosnian in the mid-90s too.
How did the novel find its form and its varied form?
I knew I wanted each character to have their own form. I knew I wanted it to be a kind of very dramatic switch from section to section to make you feel very differently as you read each section. And I wanted it to be discontinuous, because really it's about the feeling of life as being discontinuous. Because one of the things that fiction does very well is make us feel that our lives are continuous and meaningful, and that we are one personality. So we look back at ourselves at 3 and 16 and 24 and think, yeah, that's me. That was me growing and becoming. But I think for a lot of people, though maybe they don't express it all the time, there's also a feel of deep strangeness to read a letter you wrote when you were 15, or when a friend tells you about something you did when you were 22 that you have no memory of. You're constantly being confronted with this person who you don't really recognize, who's changed so much that it's quite difficult to see the through line. So I wanted to create a narrative that reflected that and reflected the shock, particularly of people who grew up in one kind of class, moving into another class. That's a particular feeling of discontinuity. If you grew up poor and you end up rich, in some way you're living two different lives.
In looking at those varieties of form, one of the things that's interesting is as you read it, and even if you read it out loud, it's not as striking as it is when you see it in print, and the font is different, because there is a continuity to the form as well.
Yeah, it really surprised me how easily people are thrown by formal visual things, exactly as you say, by speech marks and the layout of print. If you listen to it as an audiobook, or when I read it out loud, it sounds like perfectly normal realism. There's nothing strange in there. No strange words, no strange form, really. But it's a book you have to listen to, because it's about people speaking. And it's kind of constructed around people's conversations one way or another. And we're used to laying down conversations on the page in a very formal way, often with a kind of narrator who is telling you not only what people say, but how you should feel about what these people say, which is a form I love and I work in a lot. But I also wanted to the idea that a reader is an adult, and just as when they sit on a subway and listen to people speak and are able to have their own view on that, the readers can do that. They're totally capable of that. And in fact, it's that response which really interests me. Like, if you listen to Natalie at the end of the book saying, well, people get what they deserve, it interests me what readers feel that that's a fair statement given everything that's occurred before, or whether it isn't. Because it's deep in your sensibility how you feel about something like that. And the answer to that question forms your political ideas, your personal ideas, how you react to the stranger who comes to your house, how you react to your family. So I wanted to write a book in which readers were treated like adults.
There is also, going back to what you said earlier in your answer about the trickery, if you will, of what that change in font and the visual will do to the reader. You have one chapter that is made of Google Map directions, and you think of that as maybe initially strange, but that could be something very similar that you would find in an 18th, 19th, or 20th century novel.
Yeah, first of all, there's that kind of experimentation is as old as the hills, but secondly, it's not even experimentation. What's so odd to me is that most people in the West spend maybe 90% of their day looking at things like Google Map directions, at screens, at text cut up. They read, the way a 15-year-old reads online is absolutely extraordinary. They read from the middle and then they read the end. Maybe they read the beginning, they read round and about, they flick back. They have 4 different screens open at the same time. I mean, people have an extraordinary capacity to sort information. And I don't find it to be trickery to do it. I was really, all I'm ever trying to do is become more realistic. And it seemed to me, if you're in Leah's mind and you're thinking about the way home, you're thinking about it as a route, and you're also thinking about it as a map, as a thing you looked at on the way home so you could know how to get home, or the thing you're looking at on your phone. If you were really trying to convey the real experience of people these days, it would look so bizarre on the page. I couldn't even begin to attempt it. Because most of the time, our consciousness is not focused on a tree or a river. It's on this bizarre screen in our hand. I admire the writer who is able to recreate that genuine experience that you and I have most days of our lives.
Zadie Smith is our guest. The new novel is NW, and it is published by the Penguin Press. When you look at those characters and the various forms that you use, how long did you think about that before diving in for each character? It would seem like there would be thinking involved before the writing.
Yeah, there was a lot of thinking. I mean, it was 7 years, so I had a lot of time to think. With the Felix section, I always kind of went with my gut. Like, he's a kid who really feels himself to be the star of his own story. You know, he thinks of himself that way. And I remember years ago watching a documentary. I think it was about that spelling bee. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, yes.
Those kids were doing a spelling bee. And there was a little working class black girl about 7 years old. And she was incredibly funny and vibrant. And she was asked about how she hoped to win the spelling bee. And she was walking down the street being filmed, and she said something like, you know, like, the story of my life, like, it's an incredible story. I was born, I just keep on progressing and moving forward. And it was as if she were narrating her own life. She really saw it as it was a movie and she was the star. And of course, if you talk to a lot of young people, they'll admit to that feeling, though. They put music in their headphones, they walk down the street, they feel like they're the star of some existence that they are the center of. And Felix is that generation, he's that type of kid. So I wanted to give him a narrative which was completely confident and solid, in which he is the star and the focus is always on him. But for other characters who think about their lives very differently, I felt they needed a different form. And also I wanted to jolt the reader a little bit. I want it to be different than sitting watching a television show, feeling this fluidity and everything passing smoothly. I wanted to try and get the jagged nature of life in this neighborhood, and in constantly being struck or woken up to the difference between you and the person next to you, and how those differences came about, and what they mean, and whether they're fair, and what the consequences of them are. And I wanted a narrative that would create that effect.
Back to the girl and the spelling bee. Don't you often feel yourself like you're narrating your life in some form?
When I was younger, when I was the age of the girl of the spelling bee, I certainly felt that way, that I was on some path to glory in my mind. But as you get older, you feel less and less certain, I think. Things happen to destabilize your sense of yourself as the center of the universe. Obvious things like having children, but just experience of adult life. One of the things which really struck me, actually, was a girl in a radio station recently when I was doing an interview who said it to me. She was the technician, not the person interviewing me. And just before, she said, when I was reading your book, I kept on thinking, when I was 20, I was working up to this, on this mission towards get everything done before 40. I was going to have a great job and be really successful and maybe have kids. And I never thought for a second what happens after 40. I never considered it. And I thought it was such an accurate expression of a way a lot of people of my generation have felt and have been educated to think, that their life was this kind of constant progression. And then you move on the other side and life doesn't progress infinitely. There's a downhill stretch too. And one has to think seriously about what that downhill stretch means and what's to be done with it. Sometimes a lot of the assumptions you made as a young person have to change, because those assumptions were made basically on the idea that you were going to live forever. Whether you ever consciously recognize that in yourself, it's an assumption that people make, and they live under that assumption, and suddenly the assumption is taken away.
And certainly there are passages in life, but your childhood never leaves you completely. It's always a part of you.
I think so. I mean, I have a little pet theory that in writers, particularly, the childhood is very, very close. Because certainly you do meet people in adult life who you can't imagine they were ever a child. It seems impossible that they ever had a childhood. And then there are other people who seem to take it very personally and very closely. Writers, graphic novelists, classic example. You ever met a comic book artist who wasn't totally obsessed with their childhood, particularly right, between like 11 and 15? There's something about people who make art, I think, that they're deeply connected to that time. And it stays significant to them. They don't disappear into adult life and forget what they were. So maybe it's very close for writers. But for everybody, it's a thing that you can't really put down. Sometimes you try and forget it. And it's such a strange period of life because you're alive, but many of the things that real life consists of, the responsibilities and all the rest of it, don't exist. So what you're really doing is just existing. And you think that's going to go on forever. And of course, it never happens again. People become very nostalgic for that point. They go on Facebook and fall in love again with their sweetheart from when they were 12, because it's such an extraordinary period. And for me, the most extraordinary, well, the kind of people I like most are teenagers for that reason, because they have almost adult minds, but they're constantly questioning, they're kind of aggressively questioning their existence because they're free to, right? They don't have to have a job. They don't have to have these serious responsibilities. And people, I guess, tease them or think of them as callow. But in a way, they have a truth that you lose later on because they're able exactly to consider themselves from a skeptical point of view. As we get older, we just have too much to lose to take that point of view on ourselves.
The title is NW, of course, Northwest London. And when you look at it and zoom out, though, this is such a book about cities in general, about the isolation of a city and how intrusive a city can be to us in our lives.
Yeah, when I chose the title, I absolutely thought of it as a double title, not just Northwest, but Nowhere, because cities have a kind of eternal nowhere to them. And there's some things about them which we take for granted, which are actually really odd. Like my husband, who grew up in the country, often points out to me that just physiologically and neurologically, it's not, well, it's stupid to talk about natural, but it's not our normal state or our previous state to see, for instance, up to 2,000 or 3,000 faces a day. And yet that's what I do in New York. I walk the street and 3,000 human faces are presented to me in quick succession on the subway, in the street, in stores. And that becomes your normal. But for centuries and centuries, you saw about 50 faces in the day. Your family, the person who sold you milk, the person who sold you eggs. It had a kind of human proportion to it. So it interests me what happens when that brain, which was able to conceive and understand and care about this small group of people, has to find some way, if not to care, but at least to tolerate and exist alongside 3,000 people a day. It's a completely different state of being. And I like novels that take in the fact that things have changed. We live very differently. There's not such a thing as a kind of eternal existence. It changes depending on the environment you exist in.
As you mentioned a few moments ago, this novel was in the works for 7 years or so. For you, was that too long or did it feel just right?
Whatever time you write a novel is too long. From the moment you start all hopeful and then on like the first week you're begging to be let out of this thing, it becomes like a prison. It's funny, while I was writing it, I see a lot of novelists because I live in New York, and you go out for coffee with them and they're all in different, I can always spot what period of the novel they're in, you know. At the beginning there's this optimism, foolish optimism, and you meet them halfway through and, you know, it's really bad. They're just in a state of psychosis. And then towards the end, there's this kind of freewheeling thing where you can see the end. People get very excited, start writing thousands of words a day, where before they were writing 100 words a week and killing themselves over it. So I had all those experiences kind of extended, but it was punctuated by other things. I kept on cheating on the novel one way or another, you know, so I ended up writing a whole book of essays to avoid writing the novel. So it was quite productive procrastination one way or another.
The outside perception of people waiting, and even a concern perhaps that you have that an audience will still be there when the novel finally comes.
I don't know. I'm so naive sometimes. I don't think about the thing, will the audience still be there? Just because as a reader, if there's a writer I love, there's like no amount of time I won't wait for their novel. I just know that personally. If somebody hasn't written a novel for 10 years, like Jeff Eugenides or whatever, I'm sad because I'd like to have read it earlier, but there's no amount of time I wouldn't wait. It's not like if George Saunders stopped writing and didn't write for 25 years, I'd forget who he was, because it's just not that kind of relationship. It's too intimate. Whereas it's a completely different thing for, you know, pop stars, and people do forget your name within 6 months in that industry. But when you're sat at home with a book reading it, it's a very intimate thing. And so I guess I don't worry that much. But I also don't, you know, I don't think of it as a profession in that sense. I know in some ways I should, but I concentrate on writing the best pages that I can. And then everything else, you can't control, really. Your publisher does stuff, and sometimes you do things like this, interviews, but if it's not good on the page, nothing can help. So I just consider it my job to make the writing as good as possible, and I'm really lucky to have very patient publishers, very patient editors.
When you talk about luck, do you feel lucky by the success of the first book? Is that a blessing or a curse to have that kind of debut success?
Well, it's kind of, that's what I was thinking about in this book. It's kind of a bigger question than any particular success, because luck is really interesting. Like in the way you live socially with other people, the role of luck is very interesting because we think of ourselves or hope, believe in a meritocracy. That's what we aim for. And then there's this strange element, luck. But it extends beyond, as I say, individual success. Like, for instance, to be born good at maths, which some people are, or to be born as I was with the love of reading, which I seem to have had from the very beginning. To me, that is luck. That's an extraordinary amount of luck. Why do I love reading so much? And why am I so good at reading in that I can do it for any amount of time and it's filled my life up? It's been enough for me to make a life on. That's an enormous amount of luck to begin with. So that's what interests me, what you get born with and what you owe it in some way. I always felt that if I had any talent, which I think is a talent for reading, then you, in some way it's a debt that you have to repay. And I guess the writing is part of that, trying to make sense of this gift that I was given, simply to enjoy my own time, because a lot of people don't have that. It really is a gift, just to be able to sit in a room with a book and be happy as Larry, as they say in England. I'm constantly amazed by it.
There is such an energy to so much of your work, and especially in this novel, there is such energy to it. To sustain that as a writer, especially when you're writing it over a long period of time, what is the challenge in that?
That's a great question, and it's a practical answer. You have to find some way to recreate the experience of the reader. Like, so I'm trying to imagine a reader who, say, reads NW in a couple of days. There are readers like that. I'm not one of them. It takes me longer to read. But people who are having one consistent experience of a novel, I always try and think my way back into that place. And that's one of the reasons when I'm writing, I go back to the beginning of whatever I've written, by which I mean the entire book, read it over, and then start writing from wherever I've stopped, which is really laborious and takes a long time, but at least puts you in the mind state of seeing the novel as one thing, you know? Because it's very easy to become obsessed with small parts and lose a sense of it as a whole organism, because to other people, that time gap between one page and another, you might not know it, but there might be 3 months between page 38 and page 39. But the reader needs to not know that. So you need to have that fluidity as you sit down to write again. Sorry, that's a bit of a boring practical answer, but that's the truth. I reread and try and get in the flow.
Not boring at all. In that rereading, that's different than editing. That's different than looking through.
You do edit as you go along, but the problem, this is where it gets very messy, because if you're reading from the beginning of the book, and say the book, like with White Teeth, was so long, towards the end of my work on that book, I would be reading from the beginning. I should say, as a proviso, if you've written a book, you read it with amazing speed. Like, you can read 200 pages in a couple of hours because you wrote it. Your eye passes very quickly. But you're always editing as you go along. But you're hoping that you've read it so many times, it's a good enough state that you don't get bogged down. Because then the whole day is lost. You know, you meant to read from the beginning to page 300 and start again. You get onto some knobbly problem on page 57 and you're stuck there. And then you can feel like you're in a quagmire. You know, you never get anywhere. So I'm constantly rereading and editing, but hoping that I'm not going to get too stuck. But sometimes, unavoidably, you get stuck, and then you just have to keep on going back to the beginning.
You have
to have a lot of patience.
I would think. You call it getting stuck. I would think that the concern that I would have, and just the way you described it, is that you would start second-guessing yourself.
Yeah, you do that a lot. I mean, I do that more than most, I'm sure. You have to try and make sure you're in the right mood for that reread, you know, like if you have a massive argument with the person in your life, that's not a good mood in which to sit down and read, because there's going to be self-loathing, and self-loathing is going to make you take out things which probably should stay or change things which were perfectly good. So you need to be in the right state of mind, and that's another awkward thing to manage. I don't know, it's a little bit sensitive trying to get all those ducks in a row and be in the right mood to read all the way through, edit sensibly, like a sensible person, not a crazy person. So all those things have to be managed. But that's one of the things people don't say about writing very honestly, that so much of it is mood, you know? That's why writers used to and sometimes do drink so much. It's just a way of controlling the mood or self-medicating, because people get very sad, depressed, lonely when they're writing. I think drink is one way to kind of cheer yourself as you do that rereading and editing.
Zadie Smith's new book is NW. It's published by the Penguin Press. Zadie, what an honor and pleasure to speak with you. I thank you so much for the time.
It was a pleasure.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.